Our second reading this morning comes from the Gospel of John, chapter 21, verses 1 through 19. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas, called the Twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." They said to him, "We'll go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it. And now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had taken it off and jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the full net of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. When they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you've just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter felt hurt because he had said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and to go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. After this, he said to him, "Follow me." This is the word of the Lord. Today's story contains the shadows of many of the familiar Peter stories. We see the disciples casting their nets into the sea and Jesus calling to them from the shore. And we remember how Jesus first encountered Peter and Andrew as they were fishing. And then we see Peter leave the boat again, thrashing through the water. And we remember another time when he stepped out of the boat and walked on the waves. And then we see the bonfire and a simple meal. And we remember the events leading to Jesus' death. We remember the meal the disciples shared on the night Jesus was betrayed and how he told them to love one another. And we remember the bonfire in the high priest's courtyard where Peter denied Jesus three times. And we hear Jesus ask Peter, three times if he loves him. Opportunities to counter those three denials with three affirmations, an offering of reconciliation. And then we hear Jesus tell Peter that he too will follow the way of the cross, and we hear Peter respond with protest, and well, we remember the time when Jesus told of his coming execution, and Peter protesting then. He even got called Satan. I think we can see and hear shades of all of that. The bonfire and denials turn to affirmations, at least that bit for sure. I think from a pure literary standpoint, it's easy enough to see the parallels, to recognize the benchmarks of this disciple's career, the outline of his time with Jesus. Again, the bonfire and the denials turned affirmations. That's just right out there. You have to see that. It's easy. But you know who doesn't seem to see any of that? Peter. Peter doesn't get any of that. Peter is just never gonna get it. And by it, I mean most everything. I mean, let's review. First of all, what are we doing fishing right now, Peter? Didn't we leave our nets behind to follow Jesus, to become fishers of men? Was there no kingdom business to be about, Peter? Why are you and the boys out on a boat? You saw the risen Lord. That's a thing that just happened, and you're out on a boat. You've heard an endless stream of sermons and parables and teachings from this man. Could you take even a guess what he might have you do? Any ideas at all what Jesus might be expecting from you? Why are you and the boys out on a boat? And then why are you out of that boat, Peter? Why are you so exuberantly rushing toward this person that you did so dirty? It was just 3 days ago that you denied him, Peter. If you really thought Jesus was the Son of God, and then the identity of that Jesus as Son of God was confirmed through the resurrection, and you know you denied him, if you knew what you did when you denied the Son of God, renounced your God, and then encountered him, newly raised in power and perfection from the grave, why weren't you scared or nervous or the least bit repentant? Just the least bit repentant. Peter's not. He's not the least bit repentant. It's like the denials never happened. Peter doesn't see Jesus's repeated questions of, "Do you love me?" as some opportunity for reconciliation. He has no idea what's going on. He gets resentful even at Jesus's questions. Those repetitions of, "Do you love me?" hurt Peter's feelings. Peter, the denier, gets his feelings hurt. He complains that the question is unnecessary, that the answer is obvious, that Jesus must know that Peter loves him. Come on, man. I wonder sometimes if Peter is as dumb as he acts, or if he was a sort of pioneering gaslighter. I mean, we all know what you did, Peter. This wasn't some small joke at a friend's expense, some slight that the space of 3 days of time could easily heal. This was apostasy. You renounced God. What do you think the other disciples thought listening to that exchange? Was it as obvious to them as it is to us? And Peter doesn't understand the cross. And to be fair, it's probably too early for that. But he's staring in the face of the one who died by the cross and was raised from the dead. And Peter hasn't begun to understand that death itself has become meaningless, that the cross has lost its terror in the power of the resurrection, that abundant life flourishes in the places where darkness once seemed to overcome it. Peter doesn't get it, and he doesn't ask any questions about it. Instead, if we read just a little bit further, we'd see that Peter does the most Peter thing imaginable and gets into someone else's business, tries to see how he measures up to another disciple. I am so sick of Peter, you guys. Now, I know that some of you take great comfort in Peter because he stands for you as an example of God's ever-abundant grace. Peter messes up in all kinds of ways, and yet Jesus forgives him again and again and again, even seems to favor him. We look at Peter and we say, great. I'm not going to fret over my own imperfections, over the times I've gotten things wrong. And I'm not going to worry so much about being imperfect or about the possibility of getting things wrong. Jesus has still got me. And that's fine. That's good. That's great even. That'll preach. That's exactly what we talk about when we talk about unconditional election and unmerited grace. I'm into it. But I caution you, though, to see Peter as a comfort and not necessarily as a role model. Do better than Peter. Don't be the disciple who's cruising on grace. Do better than that. It's like this. If discipleship were basketball, be a Caitlin Clark, an Angel Reese, a Paige Beckers. Don't be the one getting screamed at after every practice by Kim Mulkey. Being on the bench is still being on the team, yes, but Jesus never told us to settle for a warm-up. Look, I also believe that God's grace is ever abundant, but I'm not aiming to test that. Do you hear me? I'm out here doing sports metaphors, Tom. Thanks for backing me up. Let me maybe overextend this and say that I know some other women who didn't miss in the clutch, and that's the women who stayed with Jesus through his humiliation, through his crucifixion, who witnessed the gruesome execution of a man they loved, who cared for his broken body with their own hands, and who, because of their nearness to him, their faithfulness to him, were rewarded by being the first to see him risen on Easter morning. Those are your role models for discipleship. That's putting up triple doubles. That's better than Peter by a mile. In all of these Peter stories reflected in this text, all of those experiences, all of those lessons to be learned, and Peter doesn't know why Jesus keeps asking him if he loves him. He doesn't get it. It's Peter's denials, it's Jesus' crucifixion, and it's Peter's feelings that are hurt. Oof. But those are the old stories. And this is a new chapter, a new life. And that's what Peter's really missing here. And that's the real pity of it all. You see, Jesus is inviting Peter not just to reconciliation, but to participation in the resurrection. Jesus is inviting Peter and the other disciples into a new life of astonishing abundance, daring love, unexpected joy, and yes, inexplicable danger. Jesus is literally calling the disciples to the other side of the boat, directing them from the waves to the sure ground, inviting them to a bonfire, not in the evening shadows, but in the brightening dawn, to warm themselves not in secret or shame among suspicious strangers, but in the joyful company of dear friends. A bonfire centered not on fear and humiliation, but on the affirmation of love and a commitment to service in that love. That's what Peter is still missing. And that's the shame of it. And that's what you and I had better not miss ourselves. And Peter will get there. We'll see him get there in Acts. He'll get there. But for now, he seems to think that it's just business as usual, that the boys are back together, and that things will carry on as they were before the ugliness of the past week. But nothing is the same in light of the resurrection. It changes everything. And not seeing that, not living into that, what a pity. You see, we aren't just given the resurrection as a future hope, but as a rallying cry to what is possible now. If death has no sting, why should I fear anything? If my body is to be raised again, why should I worry what should happen to it? If this world is the venue of resurrection, if this earth is God's stage for salvation history, how could I disregard it? Now, all that's revealed in the resurrection calls me into flourishing life and also provides the very means for it. All that is revealed in the resurrection transforms fear into love, doubt into hope, despair into joy. And that's a radically different way of living. Freed from all that constrains us, we can reach out to others in extravagant love. We can risk extravagant, maybe even foolish love with one another and with the whole world, because there's absolutely nothing else that matters. Nothing that can overcome love. Nothing that can separate us from God's love. Nothing that can triumph over the extraordinary power of love to bring life even out of death. Peter's not there yet. He's still in the dusk of shame and confusion. But we're Easter people. We're living into the dawn of a new day, a day where we can say, yes, Lord, you know that I love you, and then prove that love by loving others. So go ahead, be better than Peter, I dare you. Tell someone you love them, stay with those who are hurting, carry your light into the dark places, go where Peter was afraid to go. Because you know that if death can't overtake your Lord, then nothing can ultimately prevail against you. Death has no meaning in the face of resurrection. Nothing has any meaning in the light of the resurrection but life and love, love and life. That's all there is. It's a bold life of love to which you have been called, into which you have been baptized, through which you have been promised to conquer. Abundant life and extravagant love are yours now. Latch on to them with your whole being and lavish the world with them. Amen.